Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
As a state, we are dealing with the largest mass shooting in our state's history. There's so many families who've lost family members. Fathers, mothers, sons, and daughters. The tragedy, of course, is worsened by the fact that it occurred in a church, a place of worship, where these people were innocently gunned down.
26 people are dead, 20 more wounded, after a gunman walked into the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, opened fire, killing children, elderly, and a pregnant woman. The suspect, a white ex-Air Force soldier who was court-martialed and jailed for a year for assaulting his wife and child in 2012. He was still able to legally purchase a military-style assault rifle last year. We'll look at a new report about the connections between domestic violence and mass shootings, then to the Paradise Papers.
I intend to be quite scrupulous about recusal and any topic where there's the slightest scintilla of doubt.
That's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, one of more than a dozen Trump cabinet members, advisors, and major donors whose shady business ties and offshore tax holdings have just been revealed in a massive leak of 3.4 million documents. We'll speak with co-author of the Paradise Papers story, Frederick Obermeyer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Texas, a gunman opened fire with a semi-automatic assault rifle Sunday morning church service in the small town of Sutherland Springs, killing 26 people and wounding at least 20 others. Witnesses say a white man dressed in black, wearing tactical gear and a ballistic vest, began firing outside the church before entering the building, shooting dozens of people inside. Among the victims, a pregnant woman, the 14-year-old daughter of the church's pastor who was away, and other children as young as 5 years old. The suspected shooter has been identified as a 26-year-old white man named Devin Patrick Kelly from New Braunfels, Texas. Kelly was found dead in his car from a gunshot wound shortly after the shooting. It's not yet known whether he killed himself or whether he was shot by a local resident who opened fire on Kelly after the church massacre, then chased him along with another resident in his car 11 miles away from the church. Kelly enlisted in the U.S. Air Force in 2010. In 2012, he was court-martialed for assaulting his wife and child, leading to a year-long imprisonment and bad conduct discharge. We'll have more on the Texas massacre after headlines, particularly looking at how it was possible he was legally able to purchase a gun. President Trump kicked off a 12-day, five-nation trip to Asia with a trip in Japan Saturday, pressing Prime Minister Shinzo Abe for a better trade agreement and urging Japan to purchase more U.S. weapons. At a joint news conference with Abe on Monday, Trump repeated a threat against North Korea over its nuclear program, saying the era of strategic patience is over. Trump scheduled to visit South Korea Tuesday. Ahead of his visit, anti-war activists gathered outside the U.S. embassy to protest Trump's threats to totally destroy North Korea.
We urge U.S. President Trump to solve issues on the Korean Peninsula by halting the South Korean-U.S. joint military drills and making North Korea stop development of the nuclear and missile program through dialogue and negotiation, not sanctions or pressure.
Shocking new revelations reveal the ways the world's richest men stash away billions of dollars in wealth in offshore tax havens. The revelations, known as the Paradise Papers, came in 13.4 million leaked documents published over the weekend, revealing how the Bermudan law firm Appleby helps corporations and the world's wealthiest people evade taxes and obscure their ownership of everything from private planes to whole companies. Among those implicated, Wilbur Ross, who continued to invest in a shipping company tied to Russian President Vladimir Putin's son-in-law even after he became President Trump's Commerce Secretary. The shipping company, Navigator Holdings, is also linked to a Russian oligarch subject to U.S. sanctions. The files also implicate Trump's Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, his chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, John Huntsman, Trump's new U.S. ambassador to Russia, and Carl Icahn, Trump's billionaire former advisor. We'll have more on the Paradise Papers later in the broadcast. In Afghanistan, residents of the northern Kunduz province say U.S. airstrikes killed scores of civilians Friday after bombs fell on three villages west of the district capital. Residents say Afghan security forces wouldn't allow them to access the attack sites to pick up the bodies of their relatives, making an accurate account of the death toll impossible. One provincial council member said about 55 civilians were killed, while an Afghan aid worker put the toll at least 40. The attack came 2 days after 15 people were killed and dozens wounded after an attack on a fuel tanker northwest of Kabul set a passenger bus on fire. There was no claim of responsibility for that attack. Elsewhere, the U.S. military said one soldier was killed after a battle in eastern Logar province. The increased violence comes as the Trump administration ramps up the war in Afghanistan, already the longest war in U.S. history. In Saudi Arabia, authorities arrested scores of prominent officials over the weekend, including 10 princes, 4 ministers, and dozens of former ministers, in a massive shakeup by King Salman aimed at consolidating the power for his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Among those arrested was Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, one of the world's richest people with an estimated net worth of at least $17 billion. Talal's investments in many well-known U.S. companies like Apple, Twitter, Citigroup, and Rupert Murdoch's media empire News Corp. Separately, a senior Saudi prince died Sunday when his helicopter crashed near the border with Yemen, fueling speculation he'd been assassinated. The arrests on unspecified corruption charges came just hours after the crown prince convened a new anti-corruption committee with wide-ranging powers to detain and arrest anyone accused and to search their homes and seize their assets. The arrest came, as the White House said, President Trump called Salman to offer thanks for the kingdom's purchases of billions of dollars in U.S. weaponry while praising what it called the kingdom's modernization drive. The White House made no mention of the arrests. President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner was in Saudi Arabia last week. Meanwhile, the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition began a massive bombing campaign in western Yemen over the weekend, just hours after Houthi rebels fired a ballistic missile toward the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Residents of the capital, Sana'a, say bombs rained down on government's buildings, including the presidential palace, the national security headquarters, and the interior ministry. Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri resigned unexpectedly Saturday, citing Iran's growing power in the Middle East and saying he feared being assassinated like his father, the former leader Rafiq Hariri. The move stunned observers and cast Lebanese politics into disarray. Hariri made the announcement in a televised speech from Saudi Arabia that aired on the Saudi-funded Al Arabiya network, prompting speculation Hariri was forced out by the Saudi royal family. This is Hassan Nasrallah, head of the powerful Hezbollah militia and political party.
This information gives us a clear conclusion that the resignation was a Saudi decision dictated to Prime Minister Hariri, so he was forced into it. The resignation wasn't his intention, his desire, or his decision.
In Vietnam, at least 49 people are dead after the most powerful typhoon to strike the country in nearly two decades made landfall Saturday, bringing damaging winds and flooding. The storm follows flooding blamed for another 80 deaths last month. The floods came as a comprehensive new study by the U.S. government finds global average temperatures have increased 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900 and will continue to rise along with greenhouse gas emissions, with human activity as the only plausible driver. The stark warning came as part of the National Climate Assessment, a congressionally mandated report due every 4 years. The assessment was approved by the White House, a move that surprised many observers, though spokesman Raj Shah later sought to downplay its scientific findings. The report was released shortly before thousands of delegates from nearly 200 countries gathered today for United Nations climate talks, with President Trump's move to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord casting a shadow over negotiations. The talks are presided over by the Republic of Fiji, one of several small island nations that face an existential threat from sea level rise caused by climate change. This is Fiji's Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama.
We bring a message from Fiji and the Pacific and the vulnerable nations of the world to say that enough is enough. We need the political will of the parties to make the changes necessary to bring about to get rid of suffering from the people of the world.
Ahead of this year's climate talks, thousands of activists marched Saturday through the streets of Bonn calling for an end to coal production. Organizers said as many as 25,000 people joined the protest. On Sunday, thousands of protesters stormed onto the grounds of the massive Hambach coal mine west of Bonn, shutting down a massive coal excavator. The site is the largest open pit mine in Europe. In Brussels, a judge has ordered the ousted president of Spain's Catalonia region and four of his former deputies not to leave Belgium after a Spanish judge issued an international arrest warrant on charges of rebellion, sedition, and embezzlement over their role in declaring Catalan independence. The judge freed Carles Puigdemont and the other four Sunday night after they turned themselves in, ordering them to return to court within 15 days to face a hearing that could see them deported to Spain. Last month, the Spanish government seized control of Catalonia after its leaders proceeded with a banned independence referendum. In Bowling Green, Kentucky, Republican Senator Rand Paul said Sunday he's suffering from bruised lungs and five broken ribs after he was allegedly assaulted by his next-door neighbor on Friday. Police have charged 59-year-old retired Dr. Renee Boucher with fourth-degree assault after he allegedly attacked Senator Paul on Friday as the senator mowed his lawn. It's not known what might have prompted the attack, but neighbors reported the two had an ongoing feud. Senator Paul's injuries are worse than initially reported. If he's unable to return to Capitol Hill this fall, it could derail Republican efforts to pass tax cuts that would overwhelmingly benefit the wealthiest Americans. In Fort Bragg, North Carolina, a military judge has released Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl with a $10,000 fine and a dishonorable discharge, but no prison time in a case that could have seen the former Taliban captive sentenced to life in prison. Bergdahl pleaded guilty this month to charges of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy, unquote, after he was returned to the U.S. in 2014 in exchange for five prisoners held at Guantanamo. He'd been held captive by the Taliban for 5 years after he walked off his post in what an Army investigation found was an attempt to reach another U.S. base to report wrongdoing in his unit. Former Democratic National Committee Interim Chair Donna Brazile revealed on Saturday she seriously considered swapping out Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton for Vice President Joe Biden, with New Jersey Senator Cory Booker as his running mate after Clinton collapsed from exhaustion at a September 11th event last year here in New York City. The bombshell came as Brazile published her new memoir entitled Hacks, describing a DNC in disarray, with a Clinton campaign Brazile labeled anemic and tainted by what she called the odor of failure. Last week, Donna Brazile revealed that the DNC made an unethical agreement with Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign during the lead-up to the 2016 election, skewing the primary in her favor in exchange for money to keep the indebted DNC afloat. And hundreds of protesters rallied in cities around the United States over the weekend, protesting President Trump and his administration's support for the far right. In New York City, hundreds marched under the banner Refuse Fascism.
My name is Carl Dix. I'm a co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And today is the beginning of the end for the Trump-Pence regime. November 4th, here in Manhattan and in 20 other cities across the country, people are in the streets, engaging in nonviolent protest, but not as a one-day registration of opposition to Trump, because November 4th is going to be the beginning of a process. People in the streets, day after day and night after night, with one single demand. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with Sunday's mass shooting at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, a tiny rural community east of San Antonio, Texas. Just after 11 a.m. on Sunday, a man walked into the church wearing a ballistic vest and carrying a Ruger AR-556 assault-style rifle and opened fire, first outside, then went back to his truck, went back into the church and killed 26 people, wounding at least 20 more. Among the victims was a pregnant woman, the 14-year-old daughter of the church's pastor, other children as young as 5 years old. The suspected shooter has been identified as a 26-year-old white man named Devin Patrick Kelly from New Braunfels, Texas. Kelly enlisted in the U.S. Air Force in 2010. In 2012, he was court-martialed for assaulting his wife and child, leading to a year imprisonment and a bad conduct discharge in 2014. The bad conduct discharge versus a dishonorable discharge meant Kelly was still eligible to buy firearms legally. In 2014, Kelly was also charged with mistreatment, neglect, or cruelty to animals in Colorado, though the case was ultimately dismissed. In April 2016, Kelly purchased the Ruger AR-556 rifle at an Academy Sports and Outdoor store in San Antonio, Texas. In filling out the background check paperwork, Kelly indicated he did not have a criminal history that disqualified him from purchasing the firearm. On Sunday, Kelly was found dead in his car from a gunshot wound shortly after the shooting, about 11 miles away. It's not yet known whether he killed himself or whether he was shot by a local resident who opened fire on Kelly after the church massacre, then chased him along with another resident to that 11 miles away. Late on Sunday night, Sutherland Springs residents gathered for a candlelight vigil to mourn the victims of the attack.
It's very devastating, and it's hard to hear the people you know were hurt that bad, and they just died.
That's why I'm here.
Children you knew.
Yes, children that my, and Jenny, she worked in the nursery. She's like the only person outside of my family that I trusted with my kids while we were at church. It's just really hard to hear stuff happen to people that you know.
The shooting came as President Trump was visiting Japan as part of a 13-day tour across Asia. As part of the tour, President Trump's attempting to sell weapons and other military equipment to Japan and South Korea amidst escalating tensions sparked by President Trump on the Korean Peninsula. Ahead of the trip, Trump tweeted, quote, "I am allowing Japan and South Korea to buy a substantially increased amount of highly sophisticated military equipment from the United States," unquote. On Sunday, President Trump addressed the shooting from Tokyo, saying it was not the time to talk about gun control and that mental health, not firearms, is the problem.
I think that mental health is your problem here. This was a very, based on preliminary reports, very deranged individual, a lot of problems over a long period of time. We have a lot of mental health problems in our country, as do other countries. But this isn't a guns situation. I mean, we could go into it, but it's a little bit soon to go into it. But fortunately, somebody else had a gun that was shooting in the opposite direction. Otherwise, it would have been as bad as it was. It would have been much worse. But this is a mental health problem at the highest level. It's a very, very sad event. These are great people and a very, very sad event. But that's the way I view it.
In February, President Trump signed legislation repealing an Obama-era law that made it more difficult for some people with mental illness to buy firearms. Sunday's shooting was the deadliest mass shooting in Texas state history. It comes only a month after the shooting massacre in Las Vegas, where another white man, Stephen Paddock, opened fire on concertgoers, killing 59 people, injuring 500 others. He also killed himself. For more, we go to Atlanta, where we're joined by Sarah Tofte. She's research director at Every Town for Gun Safety. Her team has just published a new report on the links between domestic violence and mass shootings. Sarah, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you begin by responding to this massacre and then talk about what you have discovered?
Yes, thank you for having me. Any massacre like this, any mass shooting like this, and gun violence in America in general, we are sad and we are angry and we are, as always, compelled to action. This mass shooting in particular, every mass shooting is unique, especially to the community it impacts and the victims it impacts. We know from our research and our reporting that we're seeing a lot of things in this mass shooting that we see in most mass shootings. And that in particular is the link between mass shootings and domestic violence. The majority of mass shooters in this country, the majority of mass shootings are connected to domestic violence or family violence in some way. Either mass shooters are targeting their own family members and loved ones, or they have a history of domestic violence. And you see that here in this case, and it only reinforces the inextricable and deadly links between domestic violence and firearm violence in this country and how essential it is to ensure that abusers don't get access to firearms. Mm.
So let's talk about this man. Again, police say they don't know the reason for him going to this church, choosing this church, if there was one, and opening fire. But his record is remarkable. He was in the U.S. Air Force. He was arrested for assaulting his wife and his child. And he was imprisoned for a year in the military. This is back in 2012. He leaves the military with bad conduct. And because this attack was not a dishonorable discharge, he was legally able to purchase this weapon?
Yes. Well, while we, like you all, are still trying to figure out all the details around sort of his record and the background check itself, again, we know how essential it is to strengthen our laws, to make sure, in particular, that those that have a record of, a history of domestic violence, do not get access to firearms. That means expanding the number and types of domestic violence crimes and conduct, which would prohibit someone from purchasing a firearm, and then making sure once an abuser is prohibited, that they have to turn in the firearms we know. We know that these laws work. In fact, recent research from outside academics tell us that laws that prohibit abusers from possessing firearms and require them to turn in the firearms they own are responsible for 14% reduction in firearm gun homicides of intimate partners, right? So we know these laws can have an impact. We know they can work, but we have a lot of work to do to make sure these laws are as strong as possible.
Hmm. I mean, the findings in your report, and since 2009, more than half of the mass killings are committed by usually a white man who has somehow engaged in domestic or family violence before. Women in the U.S. 16 times more likely to be killed with a gun than women in other high-income countries, making this country the most dangerous in the developed world when it comes to gun violence against women. Every year, American women suffer from 5.3 million incidents of intimate partner violence. And then you are suggesting that this then, in these cases, goes much larger. Why especially it's critical that this be caught early, not to mention, of course, the horror of the violence committed against the women originally.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes, you know, we've heard people talk about the link between domestic violence and mass shootings. The domestic violence is often the canary in the coal mine for the ways in which these shooters can have a reverberating impact both on their families and on the communities around them. You know, and again, we would reiterate that we know so much about the links between domestic violence and firearm violence, both in terms of deaths, as you mentioned, but also in terms of the way firearms play a role in domestic violence generally. 4.5 million women report being threatened with a firearm in their lifetime. One in four victims of domestic violence say that a firearm played a role in the abuse. We also know from our mass shootings analysis that you referenced the ways that children are impacted. Of all the mass shootings we've analyzed since 2009, children make up a quarter of the fatalities, and those fatalities are driven by the connection between mass shootings and domestic violence. So when we think about this, we should be thinking about it both, of course, in terms of the women, the victims. We should be thinking about it in terms of their families. And then when it comes to mass shootings, we have to think about the impact it's having on our communities and on this country as a whole.
The company that manufactured the bump stocks used by the Las Vegas shooter Stephen Paddock to kill 59 people, including himself, and injure nearly 500 others. The company that manufactures, I mean, a word I think most people in the United States never even heard of before, bump stocks, said last week it's resumed sales of the devices, which effectively turn semi-automatic rifles into fully automatic machine guns, the way Paddock used it in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, the company Slide Fire Solutions said it would make a number of its bump stocks available online at a starting price of $180. Now, I think a lot of people are listening saying, no, Congress voted against this after the Las Vegas massacre. And even, I think, they thought that the NRA said it was okay. But in fact, this legislation did not go through Congress. Is that right? I mean, the NRA actually didn't want it to go through Congress, but just thought, okay, we can change a rule on this because didn't want it to be permanent. But the Republican-led Congress stopped even the bump stock ban from going forward.
And that is correct.
What does this mean, Sarah Tofte?
Well, I think it shows us how much work we have to do to get this Congress to do the right thing, and to do the right thing not only in terms of bump stocks, but to do the right thing in terms of comprehensive background checks, to do the right thing in terms of blocking NRA-backed legislation that would deregulate silencers, blocking NRA-backed legislation that would lessen and basically obliterate sort of state permitting processes. We need Congress to do more in terms of strengthening our domestic violence laws. But I think the failure to move bump stocks is an indication of how much work we have to do and how many people we need to join us in doing this work and turning sort of our prayers for peace and our prayers to an end to gun violence into action.
I want to go to break, then have you stay with us, Sarah. Sarah Tofte, Research Director at Everytown for Gun Safety. Her team just published a new report on the links between domestic violence and mass shootings. Mass shootings over the last, 9 years or so, more than half of them are related to domestic violence or begin with the warning signs. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Lament by Farrah Saunders here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our coverage of Sunday's mass shooting at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, a tiny rural community east of San Antonio, Texas. The governor said it's the worst shooting in Texas history. 26 people dead, 20 more wounded, including children, elderly, a pregnant woman, the suspect, Evan Patrick Kelly, white, ex-Air Force soldier, court-martialed, jailed for a year for assaulting his wife and child in 2012. Still able to legally purchase a military-style assault rifle. Our guests are in Austin, Texas, Ed Scruggs, vice chair and spokesperson for Texas Gun Sense. In Philadelphia, we're joined by George Ticarella Marr, political science professor at Drexel University, who was banned from campus after questioning why mass shootings in the U.S. are almost always carried out by white men. And we're still joined in Atlanta by Sarah Tofte, research director at Everytown for Gun Safety. Her team just published a new report on the links between domestic violence and mass shootings. Ed Scruggs, let's go to you in Texas. Your response to the shootings and what is allowed in Texas?
Well, thanks for having me today. Of course, it's a tragic time here in Texas. There's quite a bit of shock throughout the state, and especially in small communities, that a crime of this magnitude could occur. And of course, our thoughts are with those families and the victims at this time. But part of what our organization is here to do is to remind folks that there are steps that we can take, and there's a discussion we need to have about ways to eliminate this type of violence, and that no one is immune to this violence, whether in rural or urban communities, in the state of Texas or any other state. Here in Texas, what's allowed, it is rather wide open in terms of gun ownership. In recent years, our state leadership has taken to loosening gun laws in basically any way that they can. A few years ago, they legalized campus carry. They also legalized open carry of firearms. It's always been legal here to carry long guns on the street. That would include a shotgun or an assault-type weapon like an AR-15. A few years ago, there was a groundswell of some extreme grassroots activists that began working for open carry and walking down the streets of our capital city here in Austin carrying their AR-15s and having parades, et cetera. Our legislature is very much influenced by what I would call an extremist movement that believes in no gun ownership restrictions whatsoever. And they do have pull with the legislature and with our governor. And it's pretty maddening and shocking to see, actually. But our organization is working hard to have a conversation in the other direction. And we realize what we're up against here, but we are having a conversation. We are getting in the doors of the legislature and talking with folks. And you know, progress is measured here, but we are forcing them to have the conversation. And so that's where we stand.
So Trump in February signed off on legislation that would make it easier for people who are mentally ill to purchase guns. Can you talk about what's the history of dealing with mental illness around guns and this issue we've just been discussing with Sarah Tofte of Everytown for Gun Safety, mm-hmm. about people who have abused their family members being able to get guns, mm-hmm. like this man in Texas, who was mm-hmm. jailed for a year for yes. assaulting his wife and child.
I think that's, you know, we're less than one day away from this, but that's the big story to come out of this. How did this man, with this record of established violent acts, not only against people but animals, who has served a year in jail, been discharged from the military, how was he able to go out and buy arguably one of the most powerful weapons available and commit this crime? It's shocking. I think it should be eye-opening to people who may think, oh, everyone has a background check, or background checks keep weapons out of the hands of these people, that the, you know, we have safeguards against the mentally ill. That's not really true. There are so many end runs around the background check system. The background check system that we do have is not strict enough. It does not go deep enough into personal histories. And that was one element of the rule that Trump rescinded this year, was an attempt by the Obama administration to get a real handle on the mental health issue by accessing Social Security records for those people who are receiving disability due to mental health. That would be in the system, to where that would flag on a background check. And that's all it was. But of course, gun rights advocates really did not like that at all. That was touching a third rail for them of invading their privacy or something to that effect. And so one of his first acts as president was to rescind that rule. So when the president goes on international television, as he did late last night, our time, and say this is a mental health issue, you have to question, well, are you committed to doing something about the mental health issue? But actually, I think to just label this as a mental health issue is somewhat misleading, because under current law, someone convicted of domestic violence is not qualified as mentally ill. They would not be judged incompetent in a court to handle their own affairs. And that's how you would keep someone from purchasing a weapon, although federal law does say if you are convicted of domestic violence, you should not be able to purchase. It's not as if this suspect, from what we know now, would have been classified as a mentally ill person unable to take care of their own affairs. If something comes out of this that wakes up the population, perhaps it will be that our background check system is not adequate. We do not have adequate reporting. We're going to find out how he was able to obtain these weapons. And I think it will be alarming to some people.
What's interesting is President Trump from Japan, where he was pushing and boasting about them buying more U.S. military weapons from the United States, said this isn't the time to talk about gun control after this chilling massacre in Texas. Of course, last week, when the massacre took place here in New York with a truck, he said we have to cut down on immigration immediately after the killings had taken place. Now, I also wanted to clarify, he rescinded a rule, so it wasn't exactly signing off on legislation around making it easier for the mentally ill to get guns. But I wanted to bring George Ciccarello-Marr into this conversation of Drexel University. You wrote immediately after the Las Vegas massacre, where the 64-year-old white man named Paddock had opened fire on concertgoers below, killing 59 of them. You were banned from the Drexel campus after questioning why mass shootings in the United States are almost always carried out by white men. Is that right?
Yes. And to be clear, when I began to write about what had happened in Las Vegas, I was really writing about this broad question, right? And I think this is a question that we all need to grapple with. When you see these cases of sort of mass, just shocking mass brutality, what is it that makes white men so prone to this kind of behavior? And what might be going on today in our country, in which people are stoking a sort of victim complex among white men? What might be happening today to encourage this kind of behavior and to radicalize these kind of actions? And I was immediately subject to a torrent of sort of abuse and threats from, right-wing media outlets. We're talking about Breitbart, The Daily Caller, and these kind of websites. And it was on the basis of those and the purported threats that they represented that I was excluded from campus. My classes were initially canceled, despite the fact that in my classes we'd had conversations about this, despite the fact that my students are very knowledgeable and intuitively grasp what is going on in the world around them. And we're open to having conversations about these difficult things.
So your response to what happened on Sunday?
I mean, I think we're seeing this, these kind of atrocities occurring, and we need to be really asking not only what can we do. I think these are important questions. What kind of immediate institutional reforms, whether it's targeted, you know, targeted gun control for domestic violence, you know, might be effective. But we also can't lose sight of these broader questions and ask what is going on in our society today. What is happening with regard to not only white people, but white men in particular? What is going on with regard to race and gender as they function together? And in this case in particular, again, we don't know all the facts, we don't know all the details, but we're talking about institutions that also serve as breeding grounds for violent behavior. We're talking about not only sexual assault in the military, but domestic abuse of those surrounding it and those outside of it. And we're talking about other institutions as well that you could bring into the picture, institutions like policing, in which domestic violence is absolutely rife and in which it's very difficult to keep weapons out of the hands of those domestic abusers. And so we need to think very deeply, I think, about the structural role of what's going on in society. Trump is abroad selling weapons, and we've got someone who, in this case, apparently was trained to engage in violence abroad. And yet we act surprised when these people have breaks, when they, you know, fall into some kind of crisis, when they find maybe feelings of entitlement, frustrated, that they then resort to violence. You know, when we're talking about a structure and institutional apparatus that trains people in violence and that encourages them to feel as though they're on the losing side of history. Trump makes hay out of the fact that, that white men in particular feel as though they're the victims of this society despite being in absolute control of it. And this is something that is powerfully dangerous, and it's why we're seeing not only the rise in violent attacks more generally and the rise of far-right movements, but we're certainly seeing, clearly sort of some very serious incidents of mass violence as well.
You know, what's interesting, yesterday, for hour, after this horror on television, you know, it came out that there was this mass killing in Texas, and they said the worst church massacre in U.S. history, and they said the worst Texas massacre. No one was saying anything about the killer hour after hour, but clearly people had seen him, right? Some had survived, people outside, the police, he was dead, whether it was self-inflicted or someone shot him. They clearly knew. And they were talking about, one, the tragedy, and two, not saying anything. And it only led us to believe it must be a white man who did this, because we would have known, I think, right away if the person was a person of color or certainly Muslim. We know that often before when it's a case where someone is a Muslim or person of color, that's what they say immediately. Now it was just left hanging. And so you knew that this would be the case.
That's absolutely the case, I think. Whiteness is never seen as a cause in and of itself of these kinds of massacres, of, you know, other forms of violence, despite the fact that whiteness is a structure of privilege and it's a structure of power. And it's a structure that when it feels threatened, lashes out. And so that's the kind of thing that we really need to think about. Not only why is it, and I think there's a lot of attention to the fact that we demonize often Muslims or other people of color when these attacks occur. The far right, of course, jumps on any violence by people of color, and yet, you know, doesn't want to talk about the real deep structures of white supremacy in our society. And again, not just the fringe, not just the Nazi movements, but what people are going through every day and what it is that is driving people to these kinds of situations where they feel so entitled to dominance that when that's questioned, they can explode in these very, very unpredictable ways. And on targets that, are not, it's not a question of, white supremacy playing a role simply because someone is targeting people of color. We're talking about people who are having, clear mental issues. But again, the cause needs to be identified outside and beyond that. And we need to think much, much harder about what's going on in our society that makes it so sick.
And very clearly, to clarify, so what is your status now at Drexel? And explain how other people have been treated in other situations. You cannot go on campus?
Yes, that is the status at this point. I'm currently teaching classes online. My students are protesting and mobilizing to have me return to campus because there's no reason, certainly, to exclude faculty from campus for having important public conversations and for teaching about hard questions. That's what we're there to do. But what you're seeing is a broad wave of aggression against faculty. You've seen dozens of cases, whether it's, Tommy Curry at Texas A&M, Kiangi Amata Taylor at Princeton, Johnny Eric Williams at Trinity College. You're seeing far-right websites creating stoking outrage, attacking faculty members who dare to speak about white supremacy and racism. That's really the common thread of all these cases, is these are anti-racist faculty members, usually people of color, who are targeted, who are attacked, who are threatened, and really having their lives threatened over being willing to talk about what's going on in the country today.
Well, George Ciccarello Maher, we want to thank you for being with us, political science professor at Drexel. But I wanted to ask Ed Scruggs about the Plano, Texas mass shooting that occurred in September. And I bet a lot of people are saying right now, what? Yes, the Plano, Texas yes. mass killing, where an estranged husband shot and killed 8 people at a football party. Describe yes. what happened and the reaction.
One of the biggest missed stories of the year, or at least the last several months, was this mass shooting, which occurred in Plano near Dallas, a football watching party, where an estranged husband, accused of domestic abuse, or at least heavily suspected, in the process of divorcing his wife or splitting up, she was holding a football watching party like they tended to do during their relationship. He didn't like that. He showed up at the home in the middle of the party with an AR-15. They argued. He shot her. He entered the home. He shot everyone in the home and then was taken down by police and killed. This received almost no national attention on the news. I believe there was something going on with the Russia investigation during that time or something to that effect, but it received almost no coverage. I may have seen one small crawl on CNN, and that's it. Not one interview, not one report from the scene. And what's troubling about that is, one, we've become so desensitized that now 9 deaths doesn't qualify as news, but that the domestic violence component. It is, again, as I think Sarah mentioned earlier, it is a common link in many mass shootings. And this almost was a textbook case where it evolved into a mass shooting of a large scale. That was a direct connection. You can link it to this case at the church shooting, domestic violence included. The first mass shooting in the United States in the modern history, well known to many, the 1966 UT Tower shooting here in Austin. That shooter, serious domestic violence against his wife. It's just a common thing. So the media did not have its eye on the ball when the Plano shooting occurred, and it really has just stopped covering all of the smaller shootings, murder suicides. The majority of those involve domestic violence, where perhaps a spouse is killed, perhaps a child, one other person. That is happening all across the state and across this country. And we have just either become desensitized or not interested in covering that. So it's people are shocked that this type of crime could happen in the church shooting in Texas. But the truth is, it has been happening on a rather large scale, but people have just not been paying attention. And that is very disturbing to me, and I think to many other people.
And you were referring to Charles Whitman, the former Marine sharpshooter who took rifles and weapons to the observation deck atop the main building tower at the University of Texas Austin, opened fire for the next hour and a half, killed 15 people. Ultimately, he was shot dead, but again, began yes. with domestic violence. Now, I want to end with Sarah
yes,
Toff.
Yes,
very
yes,
quickly,
sir.
Ed.
I would just say that Whitman had a history of abuse himself with a very abusive father and surrounded by violence and surrounded by firearms at a very young age. I think that's something, when you go into these cases and look at them, you'll also find that with many of these shooters as well. So, you know, one way to attack gun violence is to attack domestic violence. We have a 10-year program to attack opioid addiction. We have a war on drugs. How about a war against domestic violence and spousal abuse? You'll not only cut that, but you'll also cut violence. That is what I would think.
Sarah Tofte, we just have 30 seconds, but you just came out with a report for Every Town for Gun Safety around the deep connections between domestic violence and these mass killings. What is Every Town for Gun Safety recommending?
We have to address abusers' access to firearms. excuse me. And we can do that in so many ways, making sure they're prohibited from possessing firearms, making sure they turn in the firearms they own. And we as a country have to understand more the connections between domestic violence and firearm violence. We have to care more, not just for the victim, but for their families and for our entire communities. It is the way that we will prevent mass shootings in this country and the way that we can prevent everyday gun violence as it relates to domestic violence, and we can do so much more.
Sarah Tofte of Everytown for Gun Safety speaking to us from Atlanta. Ed Scruggs speaking to us from Austin, Texas, Texas Gun Sense. And George Ticarello-Marr of Drexel University speaking to us from Philadelphia. When we come back, the Paradise Papers, how do they implicate everyone from the current Commerce Secretary to the Queen of England? Stay with us.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take ya. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go? Jamaica, off the Florida Keys. There's a place called Kokomo. That's where you wanna go to get away from it all. Bodies in the sand, tropical drink melting in your hand. We'll be falling in love to the rhythm of a steel drum band. Down in Kokomo,
Aruba, Jamaica.
The Beach Boys here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we end today's show with a slew of shocking revelations about how the world's richest people stash away billions of dollars in wealth in offshore tax havens. The revelations, known as the Paradise Papers, implicate more than a dozen of President Trump's cabinet members, advisors, and major donors. Among them, Wilbur Ross, who's continued to conduct business with Vladimir Putin's son-in-law through a shipping company, even after Ross became Trump's Commerce Secretary. The shipping company, Navigator Holdings, is also linked to a Russian oligarch subject to U.S. sanctions. The papers also show President Trump's Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, was the director of a Bermuda-incorporated oil and gas company linked to ExxonMobil, which ran a controversial scheme to export tens of millions of barrels of natural gas from the oil fields in western Yemen. Trump's chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, served as president or vice president of 22 separate companies based in Bermuda between 2002 and 2006 while he was at Goldman Sachs. The registered addresses of all 22 Bermuda-based companies were 85 Broad Street in Manhattan, then the headquarters of Goldman Sachs. Even the Trump administration's top banking watchdog, Randall Quarles, vice chair for supervision of the Federal Reserve, was the officer of two separate firms based in the Cayman Islands. The 13.4 million leaked documents also implicate Trump's Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, John Huntsman, Trump's new ambassador to Russia, and Carl Icahn, Trump's billionaire former advisor. They also reveal how millions of pounds of the British Queen's private estate were hidden in an offshore fund based in the Cayman Islands, and how the senior advisor to the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, helped funnel millions of dollars to offshore tax havens. The documents also take aim at the world's biggest companies, showing how Nike and Apple avoid taxes and how Facebook and Twitter received hundreds of millions of dollars linked to the Russian state. The files obtained by reporters at the German newspaper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, and then shared with International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. The files were then analyzed by more than 380 journalists from over 90 media organizations across 67 countries. For more, we're joined by Frederick Obermeier, co-author of the Paradise Papers, investigative reporter at Germany's leading newspaper, also worked on the Panama Papers investigation as co-author of the book Panama Papers, The Story of a Worldwide Revelation. Well, we do not have much time, Frederick, but if you could just start off by explaining how these papers were released and then talk about some of the most outstanding examples within it, who this is implicating.
Hello. We started the Paradise Papers investigation more than a year ago, and it was the results. The first results were published yesterday noon or noonish U.S. East Coast time. The Paradise Papers show actually how the super riches and how corporates hide their money offshore. It's sometimes it's illegal, sometimes it's still legal, but I think it's still illegitimate because hiding and avoiding taxes means that there's money going away, money that our countries need, our societies need, for example, to building universities, to build streets, to build schools. So I think this is a global problem. It's a problem in the U.S., but also in the European Union. And I think there's therefore a global approach needed.
So can you talk about some of the most stunning findings in this, what you were most shocked by?
I was really surprised of the huge extent of how people being very close to Donald Trump being involved in offshore dealings. I think the case from Wilbur Ross shocked me the most because we all know that he was already questioned in regards to how he disinvested. But, I mean, nobody was aware of his connection to Russia. And I mean, he now claims that the company Navigator Holding, where he is still holding some interest, that he didn't know that the company they did business with in Russia, that's a company called Zebur, that there's one stakeholder is or one shareholder is, for example, Vladimir Putin's son-in-law or the oligarch Timchenko. And I think I must admit that from a Secretary of Commerce, I would expect to at least know this, to research it. And I think it shows a huge conflict of interest that, in my opinion, should now be investigated.
Now, explain, because the Commerce Secretary, when questioned, said he was divesting from his holdings. So what does the Paradise Papers show?
The Paradise Papers show that he indeed did disinvest from most of his companies, but that he kept, even after becoming Secretary of Commerce, that he kept via a chain of offshore companies interest in Navigator Holdings and that he didn't disinvest from that one. And given the current debate in the U.S. about of Russia's influence in the U.S., I think it is very important to have a close look what went on there and that not only media, but also authorities and investigators should have a look on that one.
You also uncovered, for example, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, Steve Mnuchin. Explain what you found.
Well, in the case of Mr. Mnuchin, it is interesting that his former bank, the CIT Bank, that they helped their customers to set up structures when they, for example, bought airplanes to set up structures to avoid taxes. And this is things we have seen in many cases, and we have already seen that millions of dollars of taxes are avoided through such structures. And given the fact that nearly every country in the world needs money, needs tax money to keep up the infrastructure, keep up universities and schools running, I think this is something the public should be well aware of, that in the Trump government, in the Trump administration, there are many people with offshore ties, and that this is something they should have a close look to.
And very quickly, the companies like Apple and others, what role the Paradise Papers exposes them playing?
The Paradise Papers show that those multinational companies are looking for to find always a loophole in the global tax system. So when one loophole is closed, they try to find another one. They try to keep their taxes as low as possible. And it is countries like the U.S. that basically miss the taxes. So, for example, if when a company like Nike sets up a complicated structure in the tax haven of the Netherlands, this actually means that it is huge amounts of taxes that the U.S.
Frederick Obermeyer, we're going to have
misses.
To leave it there now, but we're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. He's co-author of The Paradise Papers. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy birthday, Andre Lewis.